The White Network presents The Heretic's Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the June 3rd, 2013 edition of The Heretic's Hour with me, your host, Carolyn Yeager. I'm returning tonight to the subject of revisionism, particularly Holocaust revisionism. Now, Holocaust revisionism is a kind of a mouthful, and it is a category within historical revisionism, but it has become so controversial in the Jew media that just using the word revisionism implies Holocaust revisionism. So that's what I will do, and if I mean historical revisionism, I'll call it that, which I do bring up some of that too, although it gets a little mixed together. A bit of preliminary news before I get started. One thing is that Tan Stoffel has installed for the month of June the music of Flat and Scruggs and the Foggy Mountain Boys as our streaming audio. And it's really a great change of pace, and I listened for a while today. Boy, it's really catchy. And you realize, or at least I had the thought, that you almost have to be white to enjoy such music. Now, I'm sure people are going to tell me I'm all wrong, and that all kinds of non-white people love this music, but mostly it's only white people that perform it, and it just sounds so white to me, and it's not music that I ever got really involved in listening to, but it's most pleasant and fun and upbeat and so on, and very skilled too, and just very, very white and probably American too. So thanks to Tan for all the work that he does in providing these streaming audios. Now, news that just came to me today is that Gunter Deckert is a free man again. I knew he should have been, and I was looking for information about him, but I got an email from him sometime during the day today, and had a bunch of pictures in it, and I used two of them in a post I put up on carolynyeager.net. So I looked around. I haven't seen anyone else mention it yet, so it must be that I'm not real late with it, but he was released on May 31st, a few days ago, and he said in the email that he would be away for a few days, but I hope to have him on my Saturday afternoon program as soon as I can. I've already asked him if he can be on like next Saturday, but probably not. But if not, then the next one. So we'll see. Very anxious to hear from him again. You can go to carolynyeager.net and see those two pictures. I thought that was enough because they're all pretty much similar. He's standing there. Sylvia Stoltz was there. And she obviously played a role in the group of people that were there to greet him as he came out. And it was a rainy day. Everybody had umbrellas. And there were probably more people there than that are in the photographs. But it's not like there's a huge crowd ever. Even when Zundel got out, there's only so many people who come out for these things. So anyway, I want to also, so we congratulate Gunter Deckert for his release, and having finally served that time that they were trying to get him to serve for such a long time. He's finally got that behind him now. And then today I got another email from someone with a Hotmail address, and it was interesting. I replied to his email and told him that I hope he wasn't going to start any gossip about me, about what he had written about, and then I wasn't, didn't think that he had it quite right, and I wasn't sure, but I didn't think so. And the email that I sent to him, the reply came back to me, because this is what's happening with me now with Hotmail again. I really don't like Hotmail. Because I have so much trouble with my own emails being accepted there. Before I got my own server, everything sent to Hotmail was returned. They wouldn't accept anything. But when I got my own server, under my own name and so on, well, then that problem went away. But now it's come back again, but not for my mailers. I don't get any notice that any of my, you know, my mass mailings that go out, like today's for today's program, are ever returned. And I used to get those, so I don't, you know, don't suppose that they are. But my personal emails going to Hotmail are not accepted now, and that's been going on for a few weeks. And Tan Stoffel has Hotmail, so it's kind of irritating. But if I'm in the CarolynJaeger.net email account, I'm just not going to try to reply to Hotmail anymore, because it's just a waste of time. And I'm not going to go to some other, as I have been doing, go to another email account and copy and paste it there and send it, and, you know, I'm not going to do that. So I'm just don't, if you're emailing me from Hotmail, don't expect to reply from me, because I can't reply. And maybe you could send it to another one of my accounts if you know what they are, but I'm not going to give them out here. So anyway, this came from John Smith, who maybe doesn't really even have an account. See, John Smith sent a message using the contact form at CarolynJaeger.net, and he wrote to me. And I'm not saying this in order to start up some kind of gossip, but just to keep myself from getting involved in gossip. He wrote to me, Mike Delaney has declared war on Deanna Spingola and RenegadeBroadcasting.com and has stated that you support him and are also at war against them. Then he says, on May 31st, Mike Delaney uncovered ATS, whatever that is, info about Deanna Spingola being Jewish. This is nuts. And publishing pro-Jewish information in the guise of pro-white literature. He called Deanna Spingola and confronted her. Deanna quickly hung up, you know, and then he says they're both a platform for hatred against, no, Renegade Broadcasting is a platform for hatred against Christianity. And, you know, I don't know who this is and what it is, but just to put the record straight, you know, I know that Mike Delaney called Deanna Spingola and what was said, and I listened to that program later that night that he had with the other two guys. And my name was mentioned in that program by Mike once, but it had nothing to do with, you know, being supporting some war he's declared. And I'm sure, and I looked at his website, ProThink, I didn't see anything like that. So that's all just a bunch of bull, and I don't want anybody to think that I've declared war on Deanna Spingola or on Renegade Broadcasting, but I do like Mike Delaney, and I'm supportive of Mike Delaney. So that's just the way it is, but I'm not in any, don't have any part in this, whatever spat might be coming up. So, ladies and gentlemen, my topic tonight is politics trumps science, basically, you know. I mean, my topic is what I said, how politics affects revisionism. But it's basically about that politics trumps science. And we can talk about using the scientific method, and we can talk about what the science shows and proves. But most people don't hold themselves to the science, and they're affected in their acceptance or rejection of revisionist ideas by their politics. And I want to go into that tonight using various and assorted examples that have come up for me over the last few weeks. And start out, I'm telling you, I've got some I got some things, but I didn't get my how I'm going to move into this taken care of very well. It's been a very, very busy day. I could talk some more about some of those things, but I think I won't. So I just say that whether you're on the left or the right spectrum, you know, it affects your judgment on Holocaust or Holohoax, whichever you prefer to call it. Usually the people further right will call it a holohoax, and the people further left will call it holocaust. But this really, I suppose I am also, I would also be included in that, although I, you know, we all think we follow the science, and we know that revisionists do follow the science. I know that the science backs up that it is a holohoax, but I might be a little bit inclined to think things a certain way because I am coming from the far right spectrum. When I say right, I'm not talking about, conservatives or Republicans or anything like that. I'm talking about the extreme right, the far right, and on the other hand, people who might say that they're moderate leftists, but really I would call them far left. Far left, in my opinion. So all of this is, you know, is a matter of how you're looking at things, and we can't get away from it. I've said fairly often that everything comes down to politics, and it does. So we'd like to leave politics behind, wouldn't we, and just like to talk about the truth. You know, we talk about the truth and the truth movement and so on. But the truth movement is totally controlled by the politics of the people involved in it. And that's a fact. So where they are willing to go is dependent on their politics and not dependent on actually truth. So, just one little example of that is how long it took so many people to accept that, Jews or even Zionists were very much involved in the 9/11 affair, and that it took years. And of course, it's been a long time. 2001, it's been 12 years since that happened, and it took say 5 years or something for most people to get around to starting being willing to talk about Jewish involvement in that. And then there are other people who wanted to say and did say that it was all Jews, nothing but Jews, Mossad and Jews and so on. And, I think it's somewhere in not at either, not at that extreme either. But even though you can say that the 9/11 truth movement has come a long way, it's very divided, very contentious, and kind of bogged down and not going anywhere. And I have mentioned this before. I'm not really going to go into that today at all as to, how well it has been kind of destroyed by infiltration and people who don't really want the truth, who are involved in it, and gatekeepers and all of that. But that's just some background, I guess, on how we are affected by the kind of politics we want to end up coming out. We want to come out with a certain kind of political regime, and so we're not going to entertain ideas, even if they may be part of the evidence or evidence backed, that are going to lead us in a political direction we don't want to go in. So. In my opinion, of course, the evidence backs going in the political direction of the right, not the left. Absolutely does, but that's the way I see it, and I'm not here to actually argue for that either tonight, except maybe indirectly. So, moving along, recently some fairly well-known internet personalities have joined in on the Holocaust revisionist side, and I have written about a little piece of it, and I have to say, on the whole, before I start, that it's good that they do. You know, it's good that they have. But I do ask how honest they are and how honest they're going to be. So, you know, I get pretty critical about it. I don't just say, oh, good, here's more people who are questioning the mainstream story of the Holocaust and leave it at that. I could. I mean, you know, I mean, because it is good to have more people. There's no question about it. And a lot of people look to these well-known personalities and say, oh, wow, you know, it makes an impression. Because for these people, moving into approval of revisionism is a huge step and a huge different way of looking at things than they're used to. So I do need to acknowledge that, which I fail to say that because it's not a method, just my habit would say, is to just jump right in with my criticism of what people are saying, rather than start out by saying, as I know you're supposed to do, well, you know, praising what they've done and saying good things, and then you lead into your critical comments. I usually fail to do that. I probably should learn to do that. It would probably make things a lot easier. But anyway, I'm saying that right now. And of course, you know, I'm suspicious of people who start talking like a revisionist, and I want to look very closely at what they're saying. And, you know, I don't know which thing to go into first, but maybe I've been following Kodo Forum, and lately, again, I hadn't for a long time, and I just looked at it because after I wrote this blog post on Veterans Today and then on Kevin Barrett and Jim Fetzer, I was alerted that there was a thread at Kodo Forum about Jim Fetzer and his transformation into a Holocaust revisionist. So and I was been following that and find it interesting and have some things to say about that. So I think the right thing to do is to start out with what's on my website, and before I do that, I should also add that the picture of Jim Fetzer with the tinfoil hat that I used from on my mailer, and I might use it for the program post, and I might find something else depending on how the program goes, but. I got that, and he wanted me to, when he saw it, he wanted me to give him credit for that. And it's true, it was made by Bill Peterson, who has a blog at bpete1969.blogspot.com. That's bpete1969.blogspot.com. He seems like a pretty nice guy and has a good sense of humor, and he's pretty freewheeling. He's got a real gripe with Fetzer, as a lot of people do. Someone who I respect, Anthony Lawson, also has a huge gripe with Jim Fetzer. And Bill Peterson has coined the term, Fetzerism. Fetzering. Which means when you, what it sounds like. I don't know if I have that coming up or not. You could find it at his blog that I gave you that told you where it was. So you can look that up for yourself if you want to. Anyway, I thought maybe that picture was probably available at Google Images. So I didn't think I need to give him credit for it, but even though I realized he did it. But it wasn't. It's not on Google Images. So somehow Google Images has managed not to have that, or maybe they don't go look at his blog, but it's only, I guess this picture is only to be found on his blog, and he's the one that created it. The picture speaks for itself. All right. It's not very flattering, but there you are. So I'm going to go to my website and talk about this, which I've been meaning to do since I wrote it, you know, a post that I wrote titled, Why Can't Kevin Hitler Burn Down the Reichstag Barrett Give Me the Credit I'm Due? And I'm You know, I know what it was that I was looking for in my notes here, and because I wrote some notes about, maybe they're way down here, about the Reichstag fire, and I haven't seen them. I'm going all the way down here. They must be here. Here it is. Okay, I stuck it at the bottom in case I would talk about it. All right. Why do I say about Kevin Barrett, Hitler burned down the Reichstag? Because I've known Kevin Barrett for quite a number of years. Now, I wouldn't say we're friends, but we were at one time a little bit friendly, a little bit, you know, kind of cautiously friendly, and emailed. I was not then quite where I'm at now, and I thought he was a good guy. I liked him. I listened to his shows. I read his stuff, and I thought he was a good truther. And I wrote, you know, we emailed back and forth some, not often, not a lot, sometimes a little bit, you know, when over something or other that came up. And I was always trying to get him to look at the Holocaust the same way he looked at everything else. I said, if you sit and talk about all these government-run, what he calls false flags, but, you know, PSYOP things, and yet you want to believe the Holocaust, and you talk all the time about how you can't believe anything any of these leaders say, but you're going to believe what they say about Holocaust. And, you know, he just wasn't very... he would say, well, you know, there's a point there, but I'm not sure about this and that and the other thing. And he was very resistant to really looking at it. And he got this friend, Keith, maybe it was somebody, who's a kind of a, who had written some good things about 9/11. And the three of us went back and forth, and I read his thing, and I was talking to him too. And he's very resistant to it because they're both left wing. You know, they're both, multiculturalists. Of course, Kevin is a converted to, Islam, and he's very serious Muslim. And they're committed to all these left values. And so they don't like, they don't want to, change the public opinion about the Holocaust, because Adolf Hitler is involved in it. So, Kevin was always saying and using in his radio program, this is one thing I'd email him about. I would hear him say, hear him bring up about how the Reichstag fire was a false flag by the National Socialist government, just like 9/11. You know, he'd make this direct comparison, and I would write to him and, you know, tell him he was wrong, and I'd argue with him a little bit, and he didn't care. It's true. He had me on his, one reason I'm a little bit angry at him is, from way back is, he invited me finally to come on his radio program. That was after the business with the book debating the Holocaust, which we'll get into here. And he finally broke down and said, cause I kept telling him, I said, you should have me on your show. And he finally broke down and said, yeah, I think I need to have you on. We need to get to the truth of this stuff. And he made out that we were going to have a real nice, open conversation about what was good about Adolf Hitler. You know, I could talk about that, and he didn't have any objection. And he said then he would make it an hour. I said, well, I think we need 2 hours. We need both hours to really get it. Well, no. 1 hour is enough to start. That's enough. You know, he was afraid. He was afraid of having me on. So by the time, though, that the program, it was time for that program a few weeks later after he, you know, set it up, he had totally changed the theme of the show, the theme of when I was going to be on, into what was that picture of Anne Frank and... I didn't look it up to find out, to recall what it was, but something like, am I being too mean to Hitler or something like that, about himself. And, and what he wrote about what our show was going to be was not like the way he had talked to me, nor what I was prepared to say. And it turned out to be a rather disastrous hour. where I had to argue with him, and he kept trying to go back to something that was very negative, totally come from a very negative position about Hitler, and I was supposed to somehow undo that, which is not the way he had made out that we would be doing. It was supposed to be to shed light on this problem so that people could see a different viewpoint. Anyway, I've always remembered that. I thought it was kind of dirty of him. And even some people thought that he didn't treat me quite right on that show, but and told him so, and he didn't much. He just defended himself kind of vaguely. But anyway, after that, we really stopped, didn't email him. I didn't. We quit communicating. And I just didn't try to change the mind of somebody like him or think that he was reachable. I understood that he wasn't. And now what came up here in this post, little article I've written, which actually I posted on the 25th of May. So it's a little bit old, but I didn't have a chance to talk about it until now. So is that, it brought up something, another thing that he did another thing to me that wasn't nice. That's what he did. He wrote this, an article, Holocaust History Denial. And this came up because he did this thing. This came up to me because he did this little deal on Veterans Today, where he is now a big-time editor. And Jim Fetzer's been there for quite a while, too, now. But I think Kevin has a better position than Fetzer, being some kind of an editor or something. And so they're all in thick with Gordon Duff, whom you all know that I have totally opposed for a long time. And what I think of VT and Gordon Duff. So, but he had announced on there that Jim Fetzer was now a Holocaust revisionist. And the things that he said, I really found a lot to find fault with in them. And so it went like this, I wrote this, before that, I wrote this. I had this email exchange with, basically, with Jim Dean of Veterans Today, and a little bit with Gordon Duff. And in the midst of that, Kevin Barrett was on this list of recipients. It was started by Anthony Lawson, and I explained all that in the previous post, which I'm not going to talk about, but which is called something like "The Liars at." Email exchange reveals the liars at Veterans Today, which I wrote the day before, I think, maybe on the May 24th. It's there on my website. And in the midst of that, Kevin wrote ironically, to put it nicely, because I was, they were telling me that I had no audience, and they had this huge audience. And I was correcting them that they were not giving me the correct information. They were not given the correct information about the number on when you Google Carolyn Yeager, the number of, entries that come up, which was around 1.2 million. Kevin wrote, "Well, Carolyn, with your gargantuan audience, you should be able to, you should, right there, you can attack VT and that'll teach Gordon a lesson." Well, of course, I answered him, because I was into emailing back and forth with these people during that morning. And I said that I didn't say I had a gargantuan audience. I don't. But when I go Google Carolyn Yeager, it comes up 1.2 million entries. Well, then a little bit later, as per that other article I wrote, Jim Dean informed me that you have to put the name in quotes so that there won't be Carolyn's by itself and Yeager's by itself and so on. So it's always Carolyn Yeager. And then it's true, it goes way down, and it was around 40,000 or something like that, a little over. Okay. So then I Googled, he told me he had, I don't know, three and a half million entries for Jim W. Dean. So I Googled, quote, Jim W. Dean, unquote, and it came up 300,000, not three point three million. And, so, you know, we're going back and forth with this garbage. And, so I wrote to Kevin, that, he had destroyed his credibility at VT, and he couldn't be seen as a real truth seeker, but a political animal. And then I made this kind of silly comment that he should stay away from the Holohawks because his approach is too inadequate. And, I use my, that I often use maybe more extreme language than I should, but it's still the way I thought about it. And, he didn't answer naturally, but I thought, well, I wonder, you know, what his, I only read that really quickly, so I better go back and read it more carefully. I'm dragging this out too long as I tend to get too detail oriented. I need to hurry up with this. So I went and read it, and that's where I found that, he had said, he had written in that article, Holocaust History Denial, which was a long article, fairly long, post, you know, written for Veterans Today, that, when he finally read a book, that was, more honest about the Holocaust, it was this book Debating the Holocaust, A New Look at Both Sides by Thomas Dalton. And he said, he wrote that one of his 9/11 skeptic acquaintances told him, he should read it. And, you know, of course, I know that I was the one who recommended that book to him. And I told him that when I was trying to get him to look at the Holocaust, and I told him I had bought 5 copies of that book when it came out, so I could give some away. And I told him I would send him one if he would accept it and send me his address. And he said, sure, yeah, I'd like to have it. And he sent me his mailing address, and I mailed it to him. Afterwards, he read it, and he wrote something about it, saying that, well, it was okay, but, you know, he didn't think that it was really as neutral as the title sounded. And that's what he said here, too. He said it's the exact same thing. And so I thought, well, you know, why couldn't he say, Carolyn Yeager sent me that book and I read it, you know, not that it's so important to me, that, you know, it's going to make some big difference. But I'm just saying about Kevin, you know, why, no, purposely he doesn't mention my name because purposely he doesn't want to associate himself with me in any kind of a way that we ever had anything, you know, anything going on together. You know, he does this stuff. So I say, you know, he's not the honest person that he makes himself out to be. Not at all, because he purposely didn't include my name. So I told him about that, and I said that, and not only that, but I tried to help him get Thomas Dalton on his program. And at the time, I was told that Thomas Dalton was a pseudonym, which it is, and that he was under deep cover, you know, and he couldn't go on a program. But later, I guess, I know that Kevin kept working on it, and he finally got him on his program. But I did break some of the ice there and tell him where to go, who to talk to. And he mentioned that he had Thomas Dalton on his show, and he didn't mention me. So, that's why I wrote this, and I told him that, and he wrote back and said, well, okay, credit where it's due. You did send me that book that opened my mind. Thank you. You know, and, I said, no, no, Kevin, that's not good enough. You've got to put it in the article. That's what counts. But he didn't answer me, and he never did, add it to the article. So that's what I think is the kind of people we're dealing with these kind of these kind of truthers who don't want to tell the truth, and these kind of Veterans Today people who are happy working with Gordon Duff and those liars over there, that they all become liars. And of course, Jim Fetzer has been called a liar I don't know how many times by I don't know how many people, and he just lets it roll right off his back. And Kevin also doesn't pay any attention to it. He doesn't, you know, he's still very, very chummy and doesn't ask any of these questions too much with Fetzer. And they all just get along in this manner. So I then turned to what he wrote about Jim Fetzer. And, you know, or... which was, he says, after he writes this thing and he's going to have a radio program about it. Fetzer questions Holocaust. Call the Spanish Inquisition. Well, it was on Veterans Today and it was also on his Truth Jihad blog. And, he says that after years, he says about Fetzer, after years of study and debate, during which Dr. Fetzer was occasionally attacked by Holocaust revisionists for his refusal to embrace their views until he saw sufficient supporting evidence. Well, that's a bunch of baloney, because there was always plenty of supporting evidence sent to him, or, you know, if anybody was trying to, Holocaust revisionists were trying to talk to him. It's always been there for both of them, for Barrett and for Fetzer. It's always been there, but they have avoided it. And it's not because they couldn't find the sufficient supporting evidence. And then Barrett wrote that when Fetzer, after studying the issue, yeah, he has finally reached a firm evidence-based conclusion that, and this is what he comes up, this is how Barrett, puts how Fetzer sees it, and their close friends, that the responsible revisionists, in quotes, or did I put those quotes there? I don't know. The responsible revisionists, who he doesn't name, who admit that there was a Nazi Holocaust, but insist that there were few, if any, gas chambers, and the 6 million figures wildly inflated, are correct. That is, you know, I mean, I see the writing on the wall because I've talked about this many times. That there is a whole faction in revisionism that wants to be a part of the revisionist victory, in which the Nazi Holocaust and the brutality of the National Socialists and the Hitler regime and so on remains in place, and the suffering of the Jews is not disturbed too much. I mean, they're still people who were badly treated and were brutalized and were what are some of those other words, made into victims and so on, and they have a big gripe, a legitimate gripe against the Germans, but especially the Nazis, and that's not going to change for these people. So this is only a partial revisionism, because it doesn't include historical revisionism of the whole World War II period, which needs to be done if you're going to make sure that you keep this Nazi Holocaust in place, or Nazi brutality in place, Nazi guilt in place. And so I just say it's all the same old Nuremberg Tribunal. I thought that was a pretty good way, I think, to a pretty good way to put it, because that's what the Nuremberg Tribunal was about. We're going to find these Nazis guilty no matter what, no matter how. They're going to be guilty. And this is what's still going on because of the politics of it. So then I, after that, after I posted this, I saw this thread at CODO Forum, and started by Nick Collistrom, who goes by the name of Astro 3, but everybody knows who he is. So, and he's a British revisionist, and his real specialty first was the 7/7 bombing in London. Was it in London? Well, in England. And he did a lot of work on that. And then, you know, he's also skeptical about the Holocaust. He spoke out about the Holocaust, did good work, and he got fired from his university. He was an academic, a professor, and but he's been very faithful. But also, he's been friends with Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett, because he's also of the liberal bent. You know, again, it's the politics, but he's a real conspiracy theorist, as they are, and he really is into 9/11 and the other ones, 7/7 and those. But he also was into the Holocaust, and they weren't. And so now he, after Kevin wrote this article, I have to go back up to something else here. He started this thread on Kodo. And did I already mention, I don't know if I did, that, you know, and I've mentioned it before, though, that in my opinion, Kodo is a moderate revisionist place. It takes a moderate revisionist stand politically, because they are, basically, it's libertarians there. Basically, the whole political philosophy or political bent of the people that run Kodo is a kind of a libertarianism. And so in that way, you know, there's no racism, there's no racialism. And nationalism is okay as long as it's kind of open. And, we know what libertarianism is. So they don't want anything that smacks of racism. And so at Kodo in the forum, that's also seen, that, you know, you don't get into anything like that too much. And the forum at Kodo is really super managed, super, super managed, to keep everything, you know, nice and pleasant and polite. And and one thing, you know, no attacking anybody else, or you can't even attack their positions. I mean, you have to just come up with some different position, and that's it. So it's kind of hard for some people to function on there without getting in trouble with the moderator. And the moderator that seems to be usually moderating the comments is M1, Moderator 1. And he's pretty... he must be a libertarian himself. He must be, he's a moderate himself. And so he's, if you're not moderate, you're going to run into trouble with him. And he's very quick, I think, to, in my experience in the past, to, delete people's posts and, shortly after they get on there. And then eventually, and to ban people if they talk back to him. He has banned so many really good people from there. And so many, there's, you know, let me just say this. The activity at Kodo Forum is just practically dead. You know, it should be a very lively place. I mean, lots of good debate going on and so on, but it's not, because every time anything gets going on there, he stops it and he puts a big damper on it. And then he deletes people's posts. It's always the people more on the right that get their posts deleted. And it's all about really getting new people on there and having them read some of this stuff, so they can get educated about revisionism. And they're very concerned about the archive. So there's, you know, every thread is archived, but they want it to be nice and clean and not have any junk in it and not have anything confusing. So that's why they clean up these threads so much from anything, you know, that's more freewheeling going on. You don't want that. So it gets to be, you know, pretty staid, and the people who are happy with the staid stuff stay there and are considered the, you know, the old timers there, so to speak, even if they've only been there a year or two. They're, you know, because they have so many comments there, and the other people have been removed or they got disgusted and left. So this is a problem I have with this forum, although I realize it's difficult. You know, it's difficult to run forums, because if one would want to go over to Roto Forum, which is totally pretty much free speech, you know, anything goes, pretty much. Then you've got these Holocaust believers over there who work in gangs or groups and run around attacking, you know, the revisionists and everything they say, and they lie, and they, you know, they call and do tons of name calling, but they also lie about things. And nobody's, you know, they get away with it because it's not moderated that heavily. So I don't know. It's, I understand. It's, I don't, that's even worse. That's even worse than it. I don't want to go over there and get attacked by these nasty talking people. I think they've made some improvements. They've corrected some of that more recently, just very recently. But they still have these guys there who run around and they lie. And if you can't get somebody, if you can't force them to tell the truth. See, at Kodo, I'll have to give them credit for this. The moderator pays attention, and if somebody is putting out a bunch of junk, he'll say so, and he'll call them on it, and he'll remove it, and he'll tell them to, you know, clean up their act. So in that way, it's good. I guess there's no way to have it perfect. So this thread that I'm talking about over at Kodo now is called by Astro 3 by Nick Kolstrom, who's a friend of Fetzer and Barrett. It's called Jim Fetzer Becomes a Holo Revisionist. I mean, he started it. And on May 23rd, 2013, at 11:02 a.m. Of course, these times don't mean anything because they're different. But he writes, two of the finest, most respected, and most outspoken U.S. members of the truth movement are Professor Jim Fetzer and Dr. Kevin Barrett. Both contribute regularly to Veterans Today, a big hitting site for U.S. military who have had enough of lies from their own government. Well, I mean, now talk about an opening that is promoting people and a website and telling the others that these people are to be believed and they're so respected, and that this Veterans Today site is for people who had enough of their lies from their own government. I think this is outrageously one-sided and biased. And what I noticed that when people, there were a number of people there who tried to give another side of that and give it and talk, you know, say that this was not true about these people, these two men in this site. And they were not allowed. Their posts were deleted and said that, you know, you're attacking Fetzer for no good reason, because this, obviously the moderator was either a fan of or just happy that Jim Fetzer had come out and said what he said. So anyway, what we have here is he says you know, he gives Kevin Barrett's announcement of Fetzer's conversion. He gives the link to Veterans Today. He quotes what he talks about Kevin's radio interview on his Truth Jihad radio. I mean, it's just so much advertising. He even tells us that Kevin is a Muslim, founder of the Mushka, Muslims, Jews, and Christians for 9/11 Truth. All this stuff in order to boost up that they're really a really big deal, and that this is really important that Kevin has said that Fetzer is now a Holocaust revisionist. And he just links to it. He doesn't say any more about it. But he also tells us that Jim Fetzer has had 36 books published. Really, 36 books? Fetzer has published 36 books? I didn't know he had that many books. But, you know, he says that to impress us about Fetzer. And he also, but I would say that Elie Wiesel has almost 50 books. And what does that make him? Somebody that we should believe? So that really doesn't mean anything. But none of this was taken down or was argued with by the moderator. And this thread originally had, at one time, had about, I don't know, 12 to 16 posts on it, but now it has 8 because so many have been removed. And some of them were good. But anyway, I'm looking for the next thing I want to say here. I guess I just got a message from someone. All right. Okay, I'm kind of finished with that, I guess, because I don't want to berate it, and I took too long to talk about it anyway. But I have, that's my general criticism of what's called the responsible revisionists, you know, the moderate revisionists, that don't get us very far except for a nice, polite conversation. And, but still, now I was going to mention some things here about Kevin Barrett. Let me get back here. I've still got a few listeners. I can't imagine. This sounds like it's been very long-winded to me, but all right. Kevin Barrett, I was looking at his Truth Jihad radio show posts. And one thing he said recently, which really surprised me, I don't quite understand it. He said, I listen to NPR. Well, we know what NPR is. It's National Public Radio, which is totally Jew dominated. I don't know any mainstream radio that is more Jew dominated than NPR is, which is National Public Radio, supposed to be, you know, listener supported and all that. God, that is so. I can hardly stand to listen to it anymore. Anyway, he said NPR, and he called it National Socialist Public Radio. National Socialist Public Radio? How does that make any sense? But for him, that's what he's going to call it, because he doesn't want to call it, talk about the Jews on there. He still doesn't like that. He talks about the Zionist guests and hosts there, but somehow, of course, he's one of those who's trying to connect National Socialists with Zionists. You know, he's all for that. He's all for it. But anyway, I found this. I wonder if anybody's going to contact him about this program, and he might answer that question, how he can justify calling NPR National Socialist Public Radio. But I want to get to the Reichstag fire, because it has to do with revisionism and how we deal with it. And back to Kevin Barrett, you know, he's all for always talking about how the Reichstag fire was a false flag by Hitler's government, just like 9/11 was a false flag by the Bush government. And he likes to connect, just no wonder he's right at home with Veterans Today and Gordon Duff. He loves to connect all these Nazis with the Bushes and the Republicans and so on. That's what he does, because he's a solid, very left-wing. He's not even a Democrat anymore, of course, just like, but he's very left and very multicultural. So he says, which, of course, Bush was too. The whole thing is so dumb. It's so confusing. But I've talked with him about the Reichstag fire and sent him information and sent emails to him. This was, you know, several years ago, not lately. And I just want to point out that even in Wikipedia, which admits that their article on the Reichstag fire has multiple issues, and they want people to improve it. But, you know, if anybody goes on there, from my understanding, to improve any of these pages, it all gets, what they do gets taken down. So I've never gone to the trouble to try to become an editor there and do all this work only to have it removed. Because I'd rather do work that actually gets put out there and gets done rather than fight this kind of system where everything you do, just like on Kodo Forum. Why I won't go on Kodo Forum? Because my experience there, it was so discouraging. And now I just can't, I guess I can't behave like these moderates do who want to keep everything on a low key and never really take a strong stand about anything. So I was, had constantly had my posts deleted. And then I was banned a couple of times, and I just said, I'm not going to waste my time there anymore. It comes to nothing. And so this is the same thing here at Wikipedia. I can't believe it's saying 60 seconds already, ladies and gentlemen, but I will go on with this Reichstag fire when I come back, and I do have some other interesting things to talk about. So I hope you will stay tuned and listen to the second half of this show. And also, I do welcome callers who, if you want to call in and defend Barrett and Fetzer or any of this, or VT or whatever, and tell me I'm all wet. I don't want any just troublemaking, but it's 830-443-4911. That's don't call until after we get back from the break. So I'll be back in 5 minutes. See you then.
Sie liegen im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten, und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken, im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken, und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie einen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als die. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Thank you. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt, was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Und welche Erbärmlichkeit!
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour on June 3rd, 2013. And the topic is revisionism and how revisionism comes down to politics for most of us. And I just checked my email account, and there's no emails there about the program. So I'll go back to SkyCon and also tell you again that you can call in at 830-443-4911. And, you know, something that I thought of during the break that I want to just stick in here before I go on about the Reichstag fire, and that is that, you know, I mentioned that CODO was seeing itself as an archive, you know. I mean, the forum was very concerned that the archive of the forum threads were very clean and, you know, cleaned up, and they made sense, and not a bunch of stuff in there that they thought would confuse the readers, they say, so that people can, you know, they can search for any subject in the CODO forum and come up with all kinds of threads about it and read them. And that's very important at CODO. That's what I've come to, more so than the current debate going on. And, you know, as I've said before, and I'm just going to say real quick, you know, it's almost impossible to debate this stuff. Maybe it's because it's, you know, unless you're both on the same side, you can talk about, you know, the scientific details and so on. But if you're not on the same side politically, there's no common ground. Because the facts and so on are not respected by the Holocaust believing side. So and the whole CODO, the whole CODO website doesn't seem to be much going on there, but they are doing a lot of work in building up their archive so that there's a huge library of revisionist work, and that's a good thing. But it seems like it's becoming more like a library and archive, like IHR. You know, I draw that comparison because it's kind of similar, you know, to what happened to IHR under Mark Weber. It's just a big library of past work, but there's no current work going on. It hasn't been for years under Mark Weber at IHR. But people who just go to that website and find all this good stuff from the past, archive there, they think it's such a valuable resource. Well, it is. And CODO is doing the same thing, it seems to me. And there are, though, people who are really working at living revisionism, and one that comes to mind is Vincent Renoir. I'm on his mailing list. He comes out with a new video, like, every other day, and they really look interesting, but they're in French. And this whole business of trying to get them English subtitles or English speaking, you know, English, an English track on it instead of the French. It's just not seeming to work out. There's different people who try to get involved, but they don't, they seem to have trouble doing it. I guess it's not that easy. But anyway, I wish it would be because, well, it's, I shouldn't think that, you know, French is not good enough, but think of how many more people would be paying attention to it in English, because Americans are more open to this kind of stuff, I think, than anywhere. I mean, my websites, including Elie Wiesel Cons the World, people from all over the world, but by far, the greatest number is from the United States. That's where, because probably of the freedom that we have still. So, the Reichstag fire. I want to mention something. Well, I won't. The Reichstag fire at Wikipedia is full of little notices that say citation lacking. And it says at the top that they need additional citations for verification. So I was talking about the Jewishness of Wikipedia and the stories that everybody who signs up to be an editor and is trying to edit these pages to be more accurate have the same experience. Their changes are removed by these Jews who want these pages the way they are. Well, so they allow all these lines in there, but they don't have any, no citations or sources. Just because you have a source for something doesn't mean that it's true, because, you know, you have to look at what the source is, and it's just some guy's book, you know, or some book by a, by a believer or by people on the left, of which are mostly what's there, and they write this stuff. So it's not all true, but at least you can find out where it comes from. But a lot of stuff is said that doesn't even have anything. It also says the article is outdated since August 2010. That is, nobody's been working on it. So it's one of those forlorn pages that nobody wants to deal with, because the people who are invested in keeping the Reichstag fire, with keeping too much information from coming out, revisionist type about it, are in control. That's what I think. And, but it does say that, historians, for the most part, it says they disagree as to whether van der Lubbe acted alone, to start that fire in the Reichstag, building, or if he had those guys with him. But, the fact that he is the one who did it is not very, disputed. There are people who have come out and tried to say, it wasn't him, you know, and they've got these far out theories, what you could call conspiracy theories, that the National Socialists had some kind of a team, you know, and they've even got some names of some of them. There's one couple of guys who wrote something of who they were and how they went in there and did this on the orders of Hitler or Goering or whatever. And but in this case, I will go with the fact that most what are called respectable or responsible or acknowledged historians do not believe that. They believe, they've come to the conclusion, I think it's pretty apparent that this van der Lubbe, how do you pronounce his name, van der Lubbe, who was a Dutch communist, very serious Dutch communist, and a violent guy, and it seems to be some kind of an arsonist who had started fires elsewhere. He was the one who was probably sent there, or else he did it on his own, went in there and did it. And he was caught in there. And from all the evidence of the fire departments, you know, people who know how to understand these things and so on, it was that he was the one who did it. There wasn't a group of people. And so most historians accept that. But people like Kevin Barrett won't accept it. And certain people who just because politically, they're on the communist side. And they want to blame Hitler's government because it's so convenient and accommodating. Because, you know, it's true that after that fire, at the time of that fire even, Hitler was convinced, and he was very angry about it, but he was also convinced that the communists were ready to trying to overthrow his government. His government was new. He wasn't real strongly entrenched yet because, you know, he had a coalition group there in the parliament. Because the National Socialists were not a majority at that point, and they had, you know, to make a majority through some other relations with other parties that had people in there, legislators elected. And so, you know, he was trying to strengthen things, and he really was, I believe, sincerely worried about the communists. The communists were very powerful in Germany, and they had a lot of support from other communist, you know, the Communist Party all around Europe and in Soviet Union and so on. So, you know, his government was a real target. And so they played that up, that fire up, and that the communists were responsible and so on. They wanted to get they wanted to pass this enabling law, but they didn't burn it down themselves in order to do it. You know, that's an idea that the globalists use. That's a thing that the Jews use, these false flag things. You know, in my opinion, in my strong feeling, and I think I'm not just being biased, but I really think makes a lot of sense. Germans, like Hitler and the National Socialists, would not burn down their own parliament building. When did they ever do things like that? They didn't do things like that. They don't think that way. They didn't think that way. They still don't think that way. It's only these other people who think that way. The Enabling Act, which did pass on March 23rd of that year. When was that fire? It was maybe in February or something. I don't know. Earlier in the year, in 33. And it had the support of the right-wing German National People's Party, the Catholic Center Party, and several fragmented middle-class parties. So Hitler had support from all those groups plus his own. And everybody was sincerely concerned about the communists and their violent way of overthrowing things. And it wasn't just Adolf Hitler and his party that, you know, like browbeat these people to do what they did. They did it. They voted for Hitler's extra power because they knew they needed somebody strong to stand up against these communists. And, you know, they had a different view. They had a very different view of this than we have, and, you know, than this libertarian view that I've been talking about. They were not afraid of a strong leader. They wanted a strong leader, and they decided after this that if these communists were really still... this gave Hitler the right to arrest, round up all kinds of communists and put them in camps. He did. You know, he did do that. And a lot of them were released after a while, and they went off to other countries. See, that's where, you know, you almost have to execute all these people because they just go off somewhere else. But he didn't want to be the kind of he didn't want that reputation that he was. He had a bad enough. They were pushing this, you know, they were trying to ruin his reputation as it was for being brutal and harsh and, you know, blah, blah. And so, you know, he didn't do that. He was strong and very firm enough to get a bad reputation for it, but he wasn't enough that he actually got rid of these people. So anyway, this Derlube was found guilty by their courts. And, you know, the courts in Europe and in Germany then, too, had just made up of judges. There's no juries. Still that way. And it was the highest court in the land that they did this in. And they had put on trial this Marinus van der Lubbe, who the Dutch arsonist, and also four communists. And one of them was a huge, big head of the whole European Communist Party, which the Gestapo did not know, or the police did not know about that when they first arrested him. I don't know if they learned about that, but and they charged him with conspiracy to set this fire, but the court said there was not enough evidence to prove that these other men conspired or had a part in it, and so there was only enough evidence to convict Derlube, which they did, and the other guys went free, but they were expelled to the Soviet Union. And when they got to the Soviet Union, they received a heroic welcome from the Soviets, except one of them was put into protective custody until 1935, and then released under a pseudonym and moved away from Berlin. Maybe he thought he was in danger. Maybe the others didn't like him or thought that he was a traitor or something. I don't know, but anyway, that's what it said. And anyway, Hitler, it said that Hitler was unhappy with the outcome. He wanted them all to be found guilty because he was convinced that they were, that they had conspired to do this, that it was more than just this one guy. But the court didn't find that, and he couldn't overthrow it or anything. So, you know, he wasn't the dictator that people like Kevin Barrett want to say he was. Now, Ian Kershaw is a very highly regarded British historian who has specialized in Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich and the National Socialists and so on in World War II. And he's not a favorite of mine, but he did write that the consensus, he said, the consensus of nearly all historians is that van der Lubbe did, in fact, set the Reichstag fire. Well, that's not good enough. That never was good enough for Kevin Barrett, because I told Kevin about that. You know, I pointed out these things in this Wikipedia article to him few years ago, and never changed. I still heard him on his program, you know, talking about, oh, just like Hitler's Reichstag fire, that false flag to give him all that power. That's what Bush did, blah, blah, blah. And another one, there's a few people to reference here. Sefton Delmer was an English journalist, and he was given a lot of freedom and special interviews and so on by the National Socialists. And Hitler himself was friendly with this Sefton Delmer. And he was there, and he was allowed to be there in the Reichstag building after they put the fire out. And Hitler and Goering and a few of the men were, looking around and being guided around in there. And Sefton Delmer was in their party with them. And he heard everything that was going on. They talked to him very openly. He says that van der Lubbe was solely responsible. And he said that the Nazis wanted to make it appear to be a communist gang, but he thought van der Lubbe did it by himself. Anyway, that was his final word. But not that the Nazis did it at all. He didn't believe that. And Fritz Tobias was a social democrat and a part-time historian, German. And in 1960, he researched this a whole lot, did a whole lot of research on it, and wrote a book and established that van der Lubbe attempted to burn down a number of buildings prior to February 27th, and he also said that Van der Lubbe is the one who burned the building. And only in 1946, though, right after the war, this Hans Gasevius, why they have him in here, I don't know, but I know who Hans Gasevius is. He was a member of the Valkyrie conspiracy to assassinate Hitler in 1944, and he was a former member of the Gestapo. He was a true traitor. He was still a member of the Gestapo when that was going on, but he was working to assassinate Hitler with this Stauffenberg group. And he indicated that the Nazis were the actual arsonists. But see, he's just a liar. I mean, I can say that about him. I'm not just being political about this. He lied about all kinds of things. And he was a definite political opponent of Hitler. And so he said that for that reason. Now, Der Spiegel, the very left-wing newspaper or magazine, okay, there was a couple of guys named Bahar and Kugel who at some, I don't have the date here, but more recently brought this subject up again. And being the left-wing people they are, they tried to argue the thesis that Van der Lubbe acted, that the Nazis did it. And Van der Lubbe was just a patsy thrown in there. This must be a more modern way of thinking that they were, they got that. Van der Lubbe was a patsy. He wasn't even actually there. All these National Socialists, some little group of them, were in there. They did it. And then they put him in there and accused him of it and so on. That's what they were saying. But Der Spiegel, who is not friendly with, the fascist Nazis at all, just the opposite, didn't go along with that and were a little more honest, and they published a 10-page response to this book by Bahar and Kugel saying that the thesis that Van der Lubbe acted alone remains the most likely explanation and that he's the one that did it. So, the Reichstag fire has just become a convenient example of false flagism, basically, to use with 9/11 truth, by 9/11 truthers. They love to cite the Reichstag fire. Kevin Barrett's not alone in doing that. So it's become kind of like an archetype because the term Reichstag fire, it says in this Wikipedia article at the bottom, is used by writers to denote a calamitous event staged by a political movement orchestrated to cast blame on their opponent. So, you know, people will, it's sometimes cited rather than saying false flag, they'll say this is a Reichstag fire, something like that, you know, which means a false flag to wrongly cast blame on, you know, on the wrong people that are your political opponents. So, you know, this is why I have so much against Kevin Barrett, you might say. And why I have the same against Jim Fetzer, even though I can say, well, you know, if they would come out and be skeptical, more skeptical of the Holocaust and speak out more against it, that would be good. You know, it would be good because they do reach a lot of people. But I still am very suspicious about about the way they go about things. And I don't like the way they word things. And so far, Fetzer, spoke more strongly about it than Barrett. Barrett's been very mild, really, calling for, as he's done before in the past, this is not the first time, calling in that article for debate, you know, or put some university chairs in place for Holocaust revisionists to have a university chair where they can do their research and so on. Well, you know, That's never going to happen. University chairs have to be funded. So who's going to fund it? The only people that fund these things are these left-wingers, practically, the globalists. That's who funds them. Well, let's see what I passed by now and get back to. I've got a half hour left. I haven't had a phone call. Probably won't have one. Let me check my email again. See? I'm remembering. But I don't see there's nothing here either. So, okay. I've got several things here. Maybe I'll just mention real quickly that it just came into my email box right before the program from Tobin, Frederick Tobin, an article by John Kaminsky. And I forget the title of it is one thing, but one of the subtitles down in about the third paragraph or so, I don't know, says, get used to it, Hitler was a good guy. So that's pretty strong from John Kaminsky. It's an article about our history being all screwed up and our World War II history being all wrong. And we need to, we need this revisionism. And he is coming out now and saying, definitely, Hitler was a good guy. I mean, as far as I know, and I haven't been following John Kaminsky for quite a long time. When I first discovered John Kaminsky, God, would have been back in 2006, 2007 or something. I just thought he was the greatest thing. I thought this guy's absolutely, I just read all his things. And then as I learned more and got, evolved more myself and so on, I started to find him being real equivocal about Hitler and National Socialism and saying a lot of negative things that I didn't think, I thought were kind of personal from him. I thought maybe because he was Polish, that he had a hard time with that or something. I've kind of been a little down on him for quite a while, but I have to mention this article. It looks pretty good. I'll just read this one, under this one heading here. Get used to it. Hitler was a good guy. Well, maybe I won't read all of it. But he says most Americans still react with, horror at the idea that Hitler was the good guy. Well, that's so true. So true. I'm going to repeat that. Most Americans still react with incredulous horror at the idea that Hitler was the good guy, only trying to resuscitate his country that had been raped and swindled in World War I, and that Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, who have been enshrined as great patriots ever since, were actually mass murderers who started that war and slaughtered 12 million unarmed Germans after it had ended. Well, that's pretty unequivocal, and I have to applaud John Kaminsky for writing that. And, I hope Kevin Barrett and Jim Fetzer listen to this. And Jim Fetzer is probably more able to go along with it than Kevin Barrett is. Kevin Barrett is still the one who has a hard time, harder time than Fetzer, I think. That's what it seems like. It goes on like that. This one short paragraph, he says, take notice that before the war, there was no money for anyone. But during the war, there was money to build every kind of weapon imaginable at that time. Well, that's so true. What if we had a depression before the war? No money. But then, once the war starts, they gear up and, they do it all on credit, on this, on that, on borrowing, on, every kind of way. You can always come up with a way to do this. He says that the whole World War II was basically a concerted effort of nations controlled by Jewish financiers, principally the United States, Britain, and Soviet Union, to exterminate the major threat to worldwide Jewish financial hegemony, which was the blossoming barter economy of Nazi Germany. Well, it's a pretty long article, and this is just a few little parts of it, but You know, this is a pretty good revisionism, although John Kaminsky's not a historian who's going to be listened to, but it's moving in that direction. So now I'm going to talk for the rest of the program, I guess, about historical and Holocaust revisionism. And there's some pretty good stuff here. And I actually took this from Wikipedia. But as I started reading it on this page, I thought it was pretty good, and I don't quite know why now, but I'm just going to start reading it and see if I can recall why. This is not right from the beginning of the page. It's somewhere under historical revisionism. I don't know what the name of the page is. It's something else. But historical revisionism is, maybe it is that, call that. Historical revisionism is conducted to influence a target's ideology and or politics for a particular purpose. Well, that's why I liked it, because it's talking about politics. Okay. They're admitting that revisionism is conducted whatever side you're on. You know, if you're on one side or the other of a historical event, say World War II or something, you know, or something even, you know, more particular than that, more specialized than that, but whatever, you know, you've got people on both sides of it, and basically, you know, politically, and so it's, you know, they're trying to revise the history to influence how this event is seen for ideological or political reasons. Says revisionists understand Plato's dictum that those who tell the stories also hold the power. Sometimes the purpose is as innocent as wanting to sell more books or attract attention with a startling headline. Often, however, that purpose is to achieve a nation's aims by transferring war guilt, demonizing an enemy, providing an illusion of victory, or preserving friendship. James McPherson, president of the American Historical Association in 2003. Now, he's a well-known historian, James McPherson. He wrote that some would want revisionist history understood as, quote, a consciously falsified or distorted interpretation of the past to serve partisan or ideological purposes in the present. Broadly understood, there are two motivations behind revisionist history: the ability to control ideological influence and to control political influence. So there you have it. I mean, it's certainly not just me saying this. Historical revisionism is totally connected with, this guy that calls me when I'm doing a program makes me so mad. It's totally connected with how you want history to be seen, from which political perspective. It's all about politics. Even though there are historians who try to revise according to the actual truth, you know, researching into what really happened and so on. But in the end, what gets published and who gets attention and so on is very much in the hands of what political ideology is in dominance in a society. So we know what's in dominance in our society all over the world today. We know what's dominant. So that's what we get. But anyway, okay, it talks about some revisionist techniques I think are interesting. Most, if not all, of the techniques used in historical revisionism are used for the purpose of deception and or denial. The specific techniques of historical revisionism vary from using forged documents as genuine sources or inventing reasons to distrust genuine documents to exploiting opinions by taking them out of their historical context. Now, this is written by the people who are politically in control of the history now. So they say that, you know, people who want to revise this history, this is This is the outlook here. People who want to revise this history are doing it for the purpose of deception or denial. So, you know, this is written. This is Jew talk. This is the Jews at Wikipedia putting out that anybody who wants it, because they've got their interests in mind, but anybody who wants it, change anything from the way it is now, which is the way they like it, official history, is trying to deceive or deny. And they talk about using forged documents. Well, who uses more forged documents and has used forged documents than the Allies in World War II and the, what you say, the official history since then and before, too, long before. So they're the ones who have really used the forged documents to set up their type of their historical story, and then taking things out of historical context, they do that too. Actually, the revisionists today are trying to correct these things that I'm talking about here. These what they call revisionist techniques. They're the ones that are trying to correct these things. But it goes on to say other techniques include manipulating statistical series to support the given point of view. Well, manipulating statistics and deliberately mistranslating texts. Well, we've seen a lot of that too. In fact, with this whole thing about the final solution, you know, the German words for extermination and eradication and so on, these German words that they, and then they translate these speeches and so on the way they want, using, you know, what these words could, were more commonly used for other meanings, they turn it into means that you want to, you know, kill all the people. So that's just an example of the mistranslating. There's a lot of them though. And instead of submitting their work to the challenges of a peer review, revisionists rewrite history to support an agenda. Well, I don't know. All of this, all our scholarly revisionists do their work in such a scholarly manner so that it can be, it can stand up to peer review. You know, they do it in the way that the historians do it so that it can stand up to that. And the popular Holocaust writings don't do that, and they're really bad. I mean, they're known to be so badly done, but it's the media that keeps that from being known by the mass of the people. And they say that the revisionists use fallacies to obtain the desired results. Well, can't go into that, because historical revisionism can be used to deny, deceive, or influence explanations and perceptions, it can be regarded as a technique of propaganda. Well, you know, we know that our revisionist work is truthful and is trying to undo these deceptions. And so it's the official work that is the propaganda. And the techniques of historical revisionism operate within the intellectual battle space, it says, in order to advance an interpretation or perception of history. Well, there is an intellectual battle space. There is an intellectual battle going on, and that's what's happening. And both sides want their interpretation of history, but I do think that you can tell there is a difference in the one that's truthful and the one that isn't. And it's often brought out, that's one of the most convincing arguments of all, is that truth doesn't need laws, and it certainly doesn't need laws putting people in jail who disagree with the certain, with the official version. So that right there tells you that if they can't defend their version without putting people in jail, and then having them be on probation afterwards so that they are not allowed to go back to the work that they did before, and they're not allowed to associate with such and such people, or not allowed to do this or that. for periods of time, like they've done with Erzsundel, especially, but also did with Germar Rudolph. He might be mostly free of that, but nobody's really free once they've been accused, once they've been convicted of this stuff. This tells you if truth is on their side. So now here's another, though, good quote I want to read from British historian Richard J. Evans, who describes the difference in technique between historians and revisionists. Now, Richard J. Evans is another very, very supposedly highly reputable British historian. He's also written a lot of books about World War II. I have one of them. Never have gotten around to reading it. But he has, it's part of a series of his books, probably three of them. I've just got one. But he's very well known, very, what do you call that? Very I can't think of it. But he writes, reputable and professional historians do not suppress parts of quotations from documents that go against their own case, but take them into account and, if necessary, amend their own case accordingly. Now, we're going to find here, like in that other quote, though, that other thing I read, that the so-called reputable and professional historians are the ones who do some of this stuff. And the revisionist historians don't do it. But anyway, he goes on. Reputable historians do not present as genuine documents which they know to be forged just because these forgeries happen to back up what they are saying. They do not invent ingenious but implausible and utterly unsupported reasons for distrusting genuine documents because these documents run counter to their arguments. So I guess Richard Evans thinks that he's one of these reputable, and he might be pretty much, considering what the documents are that are made available. And he says, again, reputable and professional historians amend their arguments if this is the case, or indeed abandon them altogether. Now, this is one thing the Holocausters won't do. You know, there used to be many good arguments or debates between Holocausters and Holocaust historians and revisionists, and the revisionists would win, but the others did not change, did not amend their argument, did not abandon their argument, did not ever give in. That's the thing that they decided to do. That's when they went all out for initiating legal measures, laws to make it illegal. And of course, that's gone a long way. I've got something to say about that before this program's over. Back to Evans says, these historians do not consciously attribute their own conclusions to books and other sources, which in fact on closer inspection actually say the opposite. They do not eagerly seek out the highest possible figures in a series of statistics. He already talked about that a bit. They do not knowingly mistranslate sources in foreign languages. Didn't we already cover this? In order to make them more serviceable to themselves, they do not willfully invent words, phrases, quotations, incidents, and events for which there is no historical evidence in order to make their arguments more plausible. You know, I'm just going to stick in here that I'm trying to get some space to write my next article for Elie Wiesel Kahn's The World about following up on my last one with Ken Walser. And, you know, Ken Walser is the one who's a historian. He's a historian. I'm going to use this stuff because he does all these things that you're not supposed to do, that historians are not supposed to do. Every one of them and more. And he's been the one who's been specialized in Buchenwald for quite a long time now, and the children of Buchenwald, which puts him, you know, in contact with having to talk about Elie Wiesel. And he's been all a big, you know, supporter of Elie Wiesel and his role there and how wonderful the book Night is and so on. Anyway, I mean, there is no evidence, no historical evidence for Elie Wiesel being at Buchenwald. That's how I see it. And I have to go over once again in my part two of this article on about Ken Walser. I have to go over all that, all the evidence that's there, supposedly, for Elie Wiesel being there and make sure that I'm right about there being no real evidence. And I've got a title for this article called Elie in Buchenwald. And it's going to be kind of a, I don't know how I'm putting this, but based on the idea of Alice in Wonderland. That's what I'm trying to do. But basically, I have to be, you know, I don't want to turn it into a funny story or anything. I want to make it into a real research project. But, you know, this has to be done with, this Elie Wiesel and this whole baloney about him and Buchenwald that Ken Walser has kept going and is still trying to keep going. And yet, you know, since my last article, and it's going to be about 2 months, it's 2 months already, I think, since I wrote that, posted that last one. That's too long, but that's what's happened. That I haven't heard a word from him. He has not published one more thing. He made claims about stuff he had written that was coming out that has not come out. This guy has to be in so much trouble, but all he's doing right now is being silent. So anyway, that's what I'm going to, I've got kind of started on it, but I'm have a lot of work to do on it. But that's what's important to me right now about this, my role in revisionism. Anyway, another thing, another category that they have on this wiki page is relativization and trivialization. And, you know, this is a new thing for, I think, under, for things that revisionists, if you see revisionists as the people trying to change true history, this is a new thing that they're accused of doing, because it's totally connected with the Holocaust. The relativizing and the trivialization, that's came up with, that horrible woman. Must have her name here. So Deborah Lipstadt, goes on and on about, I might have some quotes here. Yeah, The Holocaust and Nazism. Is that her book? Deborah Lipstadt contends that the concept of comparable Allied wrongs, such as the post-war expulsions and the formal Allied war crimes, is at the center of and a continuously repeated theme of contemporary Holocaust denial, calling them immoral equivalencies. So, you know, she's, and today that's one of the things that the Jews, what do I call them, the Holocausters, those trying to keep their Holocaust together, which includes Israel and includes people like Lipstadt and all these Jewish academics who are, like Kenneth Walser, are concerned about and talk about as increasing, as being anti-Semitic, that if you relativize the Holocaust by saying, well, there are a bunch of these things happening, and Jewish, what happened to Jews was only one thing, not, you know, the major thing. And the other is that to trivialize it, you know, by, in the same way, by saying, well, it was only a part of what happened to a lot of people, and it's not, nothing so special. Oh, you know, they can't allow that. So they're fighting that, and they call it, they've got it in on this wiki page, because they write the wiki pages. And they say under that, comparing certain historical atrocities to other crimes commonly occurs in the context of historical revisionism, a practice also referred to as relativization. Okay. Comparing one thing to another, you know, as Wiesel has always said, oh, you can't compare the Holocaust to anything else. Oh, no. It does not, they said, Wiki says, it does not make claims on facts, but moral judgments. Totally opposite. It's the Holocausters who don't want to deal in facts, but only want to deal in moral judgments. It's all morality and moralism, and nothing about facts. But they turn it around here on this page. Very funny. And they say it makes claims on moral judgments instead of facts in order to alter, that is, revisionism does, in order to alter the public perception of the first atrocity, that is, the first atrocity being the Holocaust. And anything that's happened since is not of that same quality or level. Although such comparisons may be frequent in revisionist context, their pronouncement is not necessarily part of revisionist intentions on facts, but an opinion on moral judgment. Okay, they say they accuse the revisionists of not dealing again with facts, but only dealing on moral judgment. It's just turned around, totally turned around. Now, they have a section on this wiki page on Holocaust denial itself, which I thought was pretty good. And they say many Holocaust deniers reject denier as an accurate description of their point of view, preferring instead the term Holocaust revisionist. Nonetheless, scholars prefer Holocaust denier to differentiate deniers from legitimate Holocaust revisionists, whose goal is to accurately analyze historical evidence with established methods. Now, did you follow that? They're actually saying that Holocaust deniers, which is a fairly new term, you know, that came about, I think, during that Lipstadt David Irving trial. We reject the term denier, saying it's not accurate. We prefer the term revisionist. Well, revisionists had been used for years and years until the Jews came up with the idea of using denier instead. And some aggressive revisionists, like Eric Hunt and even myself, didn't mind the term denier. But I see that it's used to harm us, so I have to kind of step back from that. But I really didn't mind being called a denier. And he certainly didn't. In fact, he's named his website HolocaustDenier.com. But I do see how they are able to use this in a way that I just said is harmful to us. So we should stick with revisionist. Because, you know, if you want to change the historical record, you have to be historical about it. You have to deal with historical people and historians and so on. So, but they say that scholars prefer Holocaust denier. Can you believe that? What scholars? You know, this is really badly written by our enemies. Scholars prefer Holocaust denier. So you can differentiate deniers from legitimate revisionists. Okay, historian Alan Berger reports that Holocaust deniers argue in support of a preconceived theory that the Holocaust either did not occur or was mostly a hoax by ignoring extensive historical evidence to the contrary. Well, of course, historian Alan Berger has to be a Jew, and they don't like the idea of calling it a hoax. That's one of my preferred positions. But they say that when you call it a hoax, you're ignoring extensive historical evidence to the contrary, which is not true. And they can't come up with that evidence, but they come up with a lot of stuff that is mostly just words and, you know, confusing people and so on, but not real evidence. So then it goes on to say, hence, as retroactive minimization of the Holocaust, Holocaust deniers have attached themselves to the Heimatvertriebene Benin, you know, that's the expellees from Eastern Germany, a home, expelled, people expelled from their home, their homeland, which was in German homelands in Eastern Germany. It says, they call it ethnic Germans expelled mainly from the Eastern quarter of Germany annexed by Poland and the Soviet Union after the war. And so they, you know, they hate that. They hate bringing up what happened to these German people. And when they were expelled, many millions of them, and many, many, a couple million died, including children. And anyway, they have, these minimization people have, attempted to use sympathy for said Germans. God forbid there should be any sympathy for these Germans, and blame the Jews. Now, here a citation is needed that they blame the Jews, that these people, these Heimatvertriebenen, never blamed the Jews. That wouldn't be good for their cause if they did that. So they don't do it, but anyway, they claim that they do here for the suffering of these homeland expellees. Moreover, when the discredited author David Irving, and see note 3, lost his English libel case against Deborah Lipstadt and her publisher Penguin Books, and thus was publicly identified as a Holocaust denier, they have to add that. They have a source for that, you know, some book, probably Deborah. The trial judge, Justice Charles Gray, concluded that, I can't believe I've only got 60 seconds, I didn't know it was so late, Irving has, for his own ideological reasons, well, we know that the trial judge said some very biased things against Irving in that trial, even though he admitted that there wasn't any decent evidence. So I just wanted to bring up here international law. Some council member, there's an international law called the Council of Europe Committee of Ministers, an international law called, there's a new additional protocol to the Convention on Cybercrime concerning the criminalization of acts of a racist and xenophobic nature committed through computer systems, something we're dealing with today. But as of November 19, 2011, 20 states had signed it and 15 others have signed but not ratified it. But some states have not, and the United States is one who has said that they're not going to because it's not consistent with the United States First Amendment. So we need to keep that going, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for listening tonight. Sorry I ran out of time. Have a good evening. See you on Saturday.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.